Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome back to The Exchange. My name's Tom Daly. My guest today is Raven Forrest Friscalzo, the host of the Tiny Vampires podcast. Tiny Vampires is a science podcast that focuses on insects that spread disease and what scientists are doing to combat them. On the surface, this might seem a bit niche, and you might think that Tiny Vampires is a podcast for special interests, but you'd be wrong. If you're the type of person who likes getting out there into nature, or just one who has a hot weather wardrobe that involves burying your arms or legs, this podcast sits at the intersection of your life. Every summer, just in my neighborhood of the United States, I hear of local outbreaks of West Nile virus, dengue fever, and Eastern equine encephalitis. But other mosquito-borne illnesses, like Zika, haunt South and Central and even parts of North America, threatening unborn children and potential parents, whether they're locals or tourists. But mosquitoes aren't the only tiny threats which we often turn a blind eye to. Each year, deer tick are responsible for an estimated 300,000 cases of Lyme disease in the United States alone. And for me, these aren't just statistics that exist in a vacuum. It's personal, because one of those people was a member of my own household, and I've seen firsthand the pain and distress a small bite from an insignificant insect can cause. It is estimated that at any given time there are about 10 quintillion insects in the world. That's a 1 with 19 zeros behind it. While the vast majority of these don't carry diseases that are transmittable to humans, when compared to the fact that there are about 7 billion people on Earth, that numerical imbalance really underscores just how massively outnumbered humans are. And while we think we have dominion over the Earth and all the creatures on it, it's a bug's world, and we're just living in it. Our ability to observe nature, to analyze and understand what we see, and how effectively we're able to diffuse the knowledge we accumulate, ultimately are our best defenses for ensuring the greatest number of people possible are staying safe and leading healthy lives. And listening to our discussion, I think you'll find that making sure that knowledge gets spread around is something Raven is passionate about, and I think that comes through loud and clear. So, if I may, let me present to you my talk with Raven. I hope you enjoy.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Raven Forest Friscalzo, welcome to The Exchange.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Raven, I wanted to kind of dive right in today and start by asking about the background of how Tiny Vampires came to be. Because many podcasters, I've found, have a pretty standard story of how they became podcasters. And that usually is, I'm working in a job unrelated to my liberal arts degree and detached from my passion. So I've turned to podcasting as a creative outlet. But Tiny Vampires, I find, is much different. It seems to break that mold. Could you please tell me and the listeners a little bit about the National Science Foundation's Social Responsibilities of Researchers Fellowship and how that's tied in with the origins of your podcast?
Yeah. So I'm a student at Notre Dame, and the professors there, they have a real high emphasis on the responsibilities of what it is to be a researcher and what our responsibilities are to the public, because most of our funding comes from the public. So what they did was they got together and they proposed a new program, basically pitched it to the National Science Foundation. And they got a short-term grant for 3 years. So what we did was we would get together for a year. It was almost like a class, but it was continual. And basically, we just talked about research ethics and learned a lot of like different philosophical techniques. And, instead of just what is my research about, it's why do I do my research? Who is it benefiting? And things of that nature. So when it came time for me to choose a project, I'm a pretty hardcore podcast nerd, and I was, of course, always talking about them. Whenever I would talk to people, I would say, oh, yeah, on Planet Money, I heard this. And, so one day somebody was like, why don't you just start a podcast? Because, like, my real big concern is how much the public and scientists don't trust each other. And so a lot of that, so through the, program, I learned that a lot of that comes from something called the deficit model, where basically scientists assume that if people just knew more about anything, that they would be more inclined to support science. But in reality, what people want to know is what people want to know. They don't want to be told what they need to know. So that's where this idea came from of, people sending me questions and then me answering it using the science. Mm-hmm. Because, I'm not sure if people care about, how, proteins get made in your DNA and it turns into hemoglobin and all this stuff. Cell signaling and things like that. So it's better to answer people's questions and tell them what they want to know than tell them what you think they should know, I guess.
Yeah. Well, no, that's just very considerate. I think people do tend to respond better when they feel like they're in the driver's seat to an extent, right, and not being lectured at.
Right, exactly, exactly, which is what scientists tend to do, unfortunately.
I've noticed one really interesting aspect of Tiny Vampires is that it's also in multiple languages, and you've recently kind of, more recently, started Tiny Vampires in Espanol.
Yes.
Why was it particularly important to you to offer the podcast in two languages?
So a lot of what I'm talking about are turn out to be tropical diseases. So things like Zika, and that it's mostly a problem in South America, like yellow fever. And although there's a lot of people that speak English in those countries, I thought, you know, we would get a much wider audience that had these things applying to their life in a much more dramatic way than just the English-speaking population.
And even if they do speak English, they probably, it's not their first language. And
right. And I'm not really sure what the stats are on how many people speak English in the world versus Spanish, but there's definitely more primary Spanish-speaking countries in the world. So, yeah, I thought it was a really good opportunity to expand out. And especially since we have a lot of Puerto Rican graduate students at Notre Dame. So it was definitely like an opportunity I felt like I couldn't really pass up on.
Very good. Now, personally, I found your background, I was reading on your website, was very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, you served in the United States Air Force?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I was a photographer and graphic artist in the Air Force. We call it the family business. My parents were in, their parents were in. On my dad's side, we track it all the way back to the Civil War. So it's what we do.
The Air Force in the Civil War?
No. I mean the military. The military.
I followed.
Yeah,
you.
Yeah.
I followed you. I'm just joking.
Yeah.
Well, wow. Back to the Civil War. Huh?
Yeah. The wrong side, unfortunately.
No reflection on anybody here today.
Yeah.
So you were a photographer in the Air Force?
Yes. And a graphic artist, yeah.
And a graphic artist. So did your time serving have any influence on your love of the sciences?
Yeah. So in the military, whenever you deploy or anything, they treat you with anti-malarial medications, which have some interesting side effects. And, you know, we're constantly, like, spraying down tents with DEET and pyrethrum and things like that. I definitely saw firsthand how a level of impact that isn't normally seen in the United States when it comes to vector-borne diseases. I mean, here we have West Nile, we have Lyme, and they're definitely serious issues, but it's nothing like, you know, when you're going to Iraq and you're dealing with leishmaniasis or other, like, horribly disfiguring diseases. So, so yeah, it's like everything we have here on plus other things. So, so yeah, it definitely piqued my interest.
For those who haven't listened to your podcast, you want to explain briefly the term vector-borne illness?
Oh, yes. Sorry about that. A vector in this case would be some kind of, like, a tick or flea or mosquito that when it bites you, it transmits a disease. So the vector is the insect and you know, that's what vector-borne, you know, transmitted disease. Yeah.
So I can't help but notice that this is a very bug-focused podcast, and I guess
yes.
We have to ask, when were you bitten by the entomology bug? Pun
yes.
intended.
Yes. So when I was in undergrad, like I have always been really interested in parasitic diseases. I think anybody any scientist, if they're really, especially biologists, if they're really honest with you, they will admit that they have a morbid curiosity. And So I think, you know, I started off with this whole parasite idea, but I'm just the scale that I normally think at is much broader. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, most parasites are unicellular, so you're just like dealing with single cells and you're back into like cell signaling and genetics and a bunch of other stuff that I'm not super passionate about. Mm-hmm. So as I learned more about it, I started learning more and more about these, the way that you really deal with it, which is to deal with the vector instead of dealing with the organism itself. So basically preventing people from getting it. And so once I started working with the insects, that's really when I got hooked. Because then you're dealing with ecology and the behavior of the insects and how can you change those to impact how many people are actually getting sick.
Now, you're currently a neurophysiology PhD student at Notre Dame. I understand that status is currently in flux. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. So I actually switched to being a master's student. It's kind of a long story having to deal with internal academic politics that's very boring and nobody wants to hear about that. But basically, in order to go into science communication, I want to do that as a career. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't require a PhD. And I would much rather spend my time working on, you know, getting better at working with the public and not really focusing on what I want to focus on. Mm-hmm. So, and long story short, it would take me another 5 years. And I've already been here for three.
Yeah, let's get down to brass tacks.
I'm going to be 34 next month. So it's time for me to have a real job.
And if you can save several dollars in the process, that's all the better.
Yeah, well, actually, for PhD students, they pay me. So, that's one thing that, like, for master's degrees, most of the time you pay them. But for PhDs, you're actually working at the university, so they pay you. Not much, admittedly. But, but yeah, that's when I, at the end of my episodes, I say, you know, funded by the National Science Foundation. It's because my grant or my fellowship is through them, and they actually pay me as if it's a regular job.
That's a sweet gig if you can get it.
Exactly. it's pretty nice. Of course, being a PhD student is no walk in the park, but it's definitely cool to be able to get paid to do what you love and to learn, which, you know, learning is expensive.
It is. Here, anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, you kind of touched upon that you want to focus on your goals more, which is science communications. And I was wondering if you wanted to elaborate on that a bit. And what are your broader goals for science communication and the research that you've done? What is it that you hope to come out of that eventually?
Yeah. So I think... Oh, geez, that's a big question.
It is a big question. That's what I do here. Yeah,
hard hitting. Okay. So I think, you know, kind of getting back to the social responsibilities program, I think that it's really important for us to communicate with the public to make sure that we're suiting society's needs. And not that we're not doing that now, but I think that it's really, you know, to use the academic term, it's very siloed right now. You know, the scientists live in their world, they, you know, publish in their journals, and occasionally we count on journalists to come along and discover our work and then translate it into a public article and hope that, you know, we didn't miscommunicate something with the journalist. And I think it leaves a large gap because journalists do what they can, but you know, they have journalism degrees. They don't have biology degrees. And if we sit there and we talk to them and we say things like vector-borne disease without explaining it, then a lot of times there's a miscommunication, and then the public ends up with the wrong information. So, you know, kind of what that turned into for me is kind of a mission to actually be good at translating science into like any type of science into something that your average person can understand. Mm-hmm. And that's not just like an educated average person. If I talk to a geologist, they're not going to understand me if I'm speaking biology.
Right.
It doesn't really matter what level of education you have. If you're not in that field, like, you're not going to understand them. And so it's really important to really translate things in a way that everyone can understand, and in a way that you're not just talking about what you want to talk about. That, you know, when they are asking questions about genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, what are they commonly called, that it's not a political thing. You're just explaining, what is this thing, and what did we change about it, and how did we do that? And, you know, then they can make the decisions for themselves. And that makes them trust scientists much more, and trust science and evidence much more than if we're just talking at them.
Now, if you thought that was a big question, wait till you get a hold of this finale question I have for you.
Okay.
Now, Raven, I feel like we are living in sort of a paradoxical time. Where never before has science been capable of doing so much good, but at the same time doing so much harm.
Yeah.
And rather than becoming more scientifically literate and kind of rising to the challenge of better managing and directing policy in accordance with, you know, this new reality, we as a society, I feel, are beginning to go a bit adrift. We're staggering around in this anti-scientific haze. You know, you have flat earthers to anti-vaxxers to climate change deniers. You know, people all over, as you've alluded to, are sort of almost revolting against things that are not immediately tangible or very easily comprehendable. And they are suspicious of experts. And this goes from your average people to their representatives who are directing this policy. So now I'd ask you to imagine that you're testifying before Congress. What would you say to impress upon the people in that chamber, and even the people, maybe the 10 people watching on C-SPAN, the importance of science?
Oh, wow. Man, can I have a few hours to type something up?
The committee is waiting, Ms. Friscoso.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, I would say that science is not a noun, it's a verb. It's not static. You're constantly figuring out what is the truth. And how we figure out what the truth is dependent on our techniques. So when we learn something new, it's not necessarily set in stone because, you know, next year we might come up with a new technique, because our ability to discern the truth is flexible because, you know, we're humans and we're basically just, you know, shining a flashlight into the dark. But that doesn't change what the truth is. And as we, you know, do experiments, as we get more data, as we analyze it, we're seeing more and more of this truth that's out there. And a lot of the mistrust in science comes from, you know, oh, we said last year that eggs were bad for you, and now they're good for you, and now they're bad for you again. And they see that as, like, scientists arguing with each other. Or any time a paper comes out that says, you know, oh, climate change is good for these particular organisms, or whatever. They see that as arguing, but in reality, it's just more information that gives us a better idea of what the truth actually is. And the truth is complicated, and, you know, we're using our tiny primate brains to try to figure it out. And so when we're doing this, it's not something to be mistrusted. Every time one paper comes out that argues with another paper, That's science in action. That means that we're clarifying what we see as the truth right now. So the more data, the better. The better we can understand the world around us in any capacity when it comes to how vaccines work or, gravitational waves. It's all a part of this thing that we're trying to do, which is use our little brains to figure out what the heck is going on. And what the heck is going on is not going to change. It doesn't matter what we believe. The Earth was, you know, round before anybody knew that it was. So so people can say that climate change isn't a thing. That doesn't change the fact that it is. And whether anybody, whether a scientist was saying that it was a thing or not, it doesn't matter. It would be happening anyway. And that's what the truth is. So, yeah, it's not relative because it doesn't change based on what you believe.
Excellent.
Hopefully that was more articulate than it felt.
I thought it was nice. I appreciate the sentiments.
Okay, good.
Well, Raven, that's all I had for you today, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to me and the Agora Podcast Network listeners. And you wanna give a little plug for where people can find your show?
Yeah, so I'm on Facebook and just at Tiny Vampires. Surprisingly, nobody took that name. And then on Twitter, I'm on Tiny Vampires Pod. And then my website is just tinyvampires.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Have yourself a great day.
Yep, you too. Bye.
Take care.